Welcome to The Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. My name is Joel Harrison. I am joined, as always, by my socially distant friend, David Taylor. I mean, he's socially distant at the best of times.
Hey, I've got where's this reputation I've got coming from? I was in an online class the other day, and my teacher went overtime without realizing it. And he's like, "Oh, I just saw that we're 10 minutes over. Is Dave still on it?"
Well, I mean, Dave, to be fair, you do get bored easily.
I do indeed.
Ooh, in joke. Well, we are speaking to you and to, I don't know what week we're in now. It feels like year 17 of the pandemic. And I am in my home and David is in his. So my first question to you, Dave, is how you doing? How are you? How's it going?
I mean, I'm going well. I can't complain. I know people are in much more difficult situations. I get along with my wife. We haven't.
You get along. That's the baseline, really.
Yeah. I mean, there's just like Sarah and I are just very lucky that we enjoy each other's company. And I can imagine for a lot of couples being forced to be in the same house all the time, all day, every day would be a nightmare. And we, you know, we don't have kids. I know that's a much more, a very big struggle for people like yourself. And we also have a really nice neighborhood that we can kind of walk around for our evening exercise. So yeah, we're doing pretty good. How are you going?
Well, speaking of kids, I mean, I was thinking this evening, as we were putting our three-month-old Antigone to bed, that she is the harbinger of doom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were actually contemplating this as well. that she was born as the harbinger of like the worst of the bushfires.
Yeah.
And then within a few months, she seems to have brought about a pandemic.
Yeah, and you know what she's doing right now? She's starting to laugh.
Yeah. Are flies coming out of her mouth?
Oh, man. I hope Kate's not listening to this one. Yeah, but I've also got a cold, as you can tell. But I don't have the Rona. At least I don't think I have the Rona. And if I do, I want you to know that I have told Kate that you can have one of my Batman black and white statues.
Okay. I'll be thinking about this for the rest of the episode.
Yeah, you have to pretend I have inhabited it.
Okay.
And you have to talk to it every day as though I'm there.
I mean, I do that.
Yeah. Yeah, see, this actually reveals a little something about me as well that I constantly need to be talked to probably. So, excuse me. So, Dave came round earlier this week to drop off a microphone. And he plopped onto the balcony and then stood in the courtyard and graced me with his presence and talked while I whittled away the minutes that I had left before I had to go pick up Ambrose. And it really actually sheeted home to me probably something about my personality, because then he left and I was kind of like, what is this emptiness I feel inside? What do I do now? Which is probably a little too self-revelatory, a little too Phil Wilcox wanting me to speak about my heart song. So maybe I'll just park that one.
Well, I enjoyed the experience because it made me feel like I was a Roman client to your what's the term for it?
The
benefactor, the patron, where I have to come and stand in your courtyard every morning.
Yeah. Yeah, or like someone throwing up roses or something. You know, you went Roman patronage, but we could go into like throwing me favors.
Yeah, was my tunic a bit too short? Or
I mean, you could bother to show a little more. Anyway, this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about our pandemic and about COVID-19. And I feel like it's necessary to posit this, to put forward a caveat at the beginning, is that, you know, we're going to be a little speculative as always, but also that you don't necessarily need to listen to us on this. It seems there's enough people in the world trying to give their perspective with a sort of frantic pace that adding our own voices is entirely unnecessary perhaps. But you know, I thought, well, let's do it because this is what we do. And also, I kind of feel like when we speak to each other, it's almost like a form of therapy.
Yes.
You know, as in like these ideas bounce around in my head, and if they don't get out, I'll probably get a stomach ulcer. So I've got to say...
Or bore the hell out of your wife.
Well, no, that is undoubtedly true. So what are we going to talk about? Well, I mean, I was fascinated by the most recent episodes of a show we both like, The Minefield, where they were talking about the bonds of society and how this pandemic affects those and what may be on the other side. And then I thought, well, for us and our discussions, it's interesting to think about this as a matter of theological anthropology and what is this crisis say about us as persons? How do we understand the nature of the person, his or her ends? And whether those are embedded within or how they're embedded within an understanding of our politics and shared life. And in next week, I think we're going to discuss matters related more directly to the church and its practices. But this struck home for me, and I think in two comments related to our pandemic in Australia that I think really draw out some interesting themes about anthropology and theology, and then also about the nature of our politics. So one was not so much a comment, but just a practice. You would have seen Australia became the leading proponent, Australians became the leading proponent in toilet paper hoarding. And then this was also coupled with such actions as groups, very large groups of 20s and 30s especially, going down to Bondi Beach in the midst of what should have been social distancing rules in order to experience their fun day in the sun, right? At a time in which there were quite significant pockets of COVID-19 propping up across the Bondi region. Now, that is perhaps trivial, but I think raises some interesting things. One was that ScoMo, our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, said that the toilet paper hoarding in this Bondi excursion, for example, was an un-Australian act, an un-Australian act. And the second component, I think, was that there were some Christian commentators, partly tongue-in-cheek, but I think with some seriousness, saying things like, this is why I believe in total depravity. Now, I think that discloses something interesting, and I think it has connections to the Prime Minister's comments that this is un-Australian. So I want us to work through those two things by first beginning with the second of those, this notion of total depravity in the context of people hoarding, right? Hoarding toilet paper or hoarding pasta or hoarding various goods and so on, and then also trying to engage in their own perpetual entertainment through things like going to the beach and so on. You know, you can't rob me of such entitlements. So the idea that this may, that points to what some people are saying, oh, this is total depravity, well, you know, and then working our way from that into how that image of total depravity or that understanding can affect our social and political understanding of who we are as a people, right? Which then brings us to ScoMo's comment that we are un-Australian. So I got thinking about this with total depravity, going back to then Augustine and then working through to shifts in thinking on human nature that you get with reformers, right? So for Augustine, we can exercise free will towards the good, but this has been diminished by original sin and our own sin. So he variously describes this as we have our minds darkened, for example, and we need illumination, or that we're in bondage and we require liberation, or that we're sick, we're in need of a physician for healing. And this, of course, reflects Christ's own words in Mark chapter 2, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. So here, sin is, for Augustine, following on from this, a disease that then can beget further sin. It further breaks down the bonds of love between God and the person and others. Now, he was writing against Pelagius, of course, who thought we could simply choose to be good. God had given us an instruction manual, as it were, and we had the capacity to choose for good. No, Augustine says we can't. We need God's grace at every moment. But he does see this, I think, as restoring the person's inner workings. It redirects the person back to God, grace enables us to choose rightly and therefore to cooperate with God.
Mm.
Now, I find this a very realistic and honest and serious understanding of the person. You know, you think of like St. Paul when he writes about, I do not understand my own actions. I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate, right?
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing from my mind for Augustine, and you can correct me or complicate it if you want, but for me, with Augustine, our nature is never divorced from grace. God's grace is active in the person before conversion even. Mm. So we then come to cooperate with God in the renewal of human nature.
Yep.
God's grace becomes infused in the person. And so it's a process of then making us righteous.
Yep.
And I think it's easier then on that account that Augustine puts forward that we can think of human actions as a response to God, to a God who deifies. God completes human action. He renews or regenerates human nature. And that means then we have a capacity to build community or some right desires that go awry and cannot find their completion or they're imperfectly realized. And God in his grace draws us towards that completion and regeneration, right? So illumination is a key image here. And you see it in something like Pope Francis with his encyclical Lumen Fidei, for example.
Mm.
Right, illumination, excuse me, the idea of reforming our vision. So we are attracted to something, but we cannot see it properly. Yep. So we need that reforming of that, illuminating of our vision, the removal of darkness that occludes our vision. So reason here, so our reasoning, for example, dimly perceives that there is an end, there is a truth, there is a good to be pursued, but it is always thwarted. It can never reach its completion. It needs God to restore us, right?
Mm.
A God who is never entirely absent.
Mm.
Now, I think this is fascinating because to my mind, in the Lutheran and then the Reformed understanding, there is a reworking of this understanding of human nature and how grace works. And now I think, you know, some people would say that the Reformed understanding picks up on Augustine again.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but I don't know. I mean, to my mind, there seems to be distinctions that can be made.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, for Luther, if we turn then to the Reformation, excuse me, I'm just going to keep on coughing through this entire episode, unfortunately. For Luther, God's justifying grace remains wholly alien. It's imputed to the person. So for Luther, we remain sinners in our nature, but are considered righteous extrinsically through God's alien grace. So God comes to see us as righteous, right? Because he's essentially seeing his own imputed grace, while our nature remains the same, right? So whereas Augustine saw it as the renewal of human nature, right? The restoration, the process of making us righteous, for Luther, there is more of an imputation. So the person remains fundamentally sinner in their nature, but God bestows upon them or considers them righteous extrinsically because they God sees his own alien grace upon them.
Yeah. I mean, Luther would, I guess Luther is suspicious of the concept of virtue, but in Lutheran and then Calvinist thought, sanctification is possible. So the increase in holiness over time. Yet, with the caveat that our deeds will always have the taint of sin upon them, so that even the best of our works are unacceptable on their own merit because they are tainted by sin, and even the smallest infection of sin is enough to deserve damnation. And so we therefore need that imputed righteousness where God sees mirrored back to himself his own righteousness that's granted through Christ in conversion.
So this is then where you get the idea of like what you're just saying there, that all our actions are necessarily tainted by sin, right? So
yes,
this is the mode of total depravity that you can get, right? Our nature is entirely consumed by the fall. Mm. So there isn't then an understanding that the person may aspire to even understand a conception of natural law perhaps, right? Yep. But all our actions are sinful because they are not in their nature. They are not inclined to God, to the love of God. All our action originates in wicked human desire. So this is total depravity. So in this understanding, which brings us back, this is maybe a long-winded way of getting there, right?
Yeah.
But then brings us back to the toilet paper hoarder.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the toilet paper hoarder on this account is acting consistent with human nature.
Yes.
That is just human nature in kind of its stark relief on that account, if I understand it correctly.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. So, I mean, getting back to Augustine, I mean, the idea of original sin is certainly there. And, you know, he has a very pessimistic, he has simultaneously a very pessimistic and also humanistic understanding of human nature, in that human beings obviously bear the image of God and are glorious, but they're also from earliest infancy in Augustine inclined towards evil. And so he's got, you know, very confronting passages about the evidence that he sees that babies are assholes. including, you know, crying and being greedy and soiling themselves and things like that. And then, you know, his understanding of sexuality is quite, so, you know, he thinks involuntary erection is a sign of our, and coming from a very, you know, Platonic position of any unwilled action that it comes out of our pure animal existence is intrinsically sinful, but it's complex. And I think even in Calvin, it's been a long time since I've read anything Calvinist, but my understanding is that similarly, Calvin is so despairing of human sin because he has such a deeply humanistic vision, that is, that humanity are capable of such glories that makes their shortfalling so repugnant, morally speaking. So it's not simply that human beings are garbage, it's their garbage in comparison to what they are made to be.
Oh, that's interesting, because I mean, maybe that's a complication, because there are a number of thinkers that think the problem with this view of total depravity and so on is that it's far too pessimistic, and then that it actually becomes a sort of theological warrant for what becomes the sort of substrata for liberal thinking.
But I would say those thinkers are correct, and I certainly know, at least in my experience within the Calvinist tradition, that this does have an outworking towards an extreme pessimism towards any human project. So, because human beings are so tainted by evil because of original sin and total depravity, any collective action, even on a civilizational or societal level, will necessarily just compound sin. And so there's a real sense that we need to be very minimalistic and very humble in our aspirations towards creating a society together. But at the same time, that is coupled paradoxically with a strong emphasis on the punitive aspect of the state. Mm. And this is present in Luther as well.
Yeah, his line is, "The ruler's sword must be red and bloody, for the world will and must be evil."
Yes. So
and he also refers to God riding the person like a donkey.
Yeah, that's right. So you've got this vision where you've got basically the state needs to be minimalistic, because if we create it too big, that's just a human artifice that's tainted by sin, and so sin is just increasing. But at the same time, we need a strong state that's punitive in order to punish and discipline the sinful citizens that make it up. So when you take those things in combination, the minimal state with humble aspirations towards creating a common good, and then a strong punitive state, then you actually basically have the neoconservative American vision of politics coming out of a form of evangelicalism. And so I don't think those critics of Calvinism are necessarily wrong. I don't have the expertise to know whether it's a fair assessment of the source material.
Let me break it down a little further, right? So it has like an economic and political content to it. And essentially you could argue it and say, a lot of visions of the liberal polity from, like, you know, the early progenitors, like someone like Locke and Hobbes, and then mm-hmm. or like Adam Smith on an economic side, it's almost like that view of total depravity without sanctification.
Yeah.
So you get in Hobbes, right? The natural law for Hobbes is reduced down to mutual self-preservation.
Yep.
And then you need Leviathan, the state, to ensure that we don't, first of all, kill each other and then yep. interfere with each other's property rights, right? But yep. essentially what you've got there...
the core of human rationality is... So the only reliable element of human rationality is the desire for self-preservation.
That's right. So so at fundamental, you have self-interested individuals willing for their own preservation, right? Mm. And then you see in Locke, he refers to a person having a property in his own self, right? Mm. You have a property in your own person. And that's because you are, you know, you are, again, a self-willing individual, right? And mm. so there's this understanding there that you are, in a certain sense, there's a certain kind of selfishness that then needs to be mediated by a civil authority. Yeah. And in the economic side of it, you get Adam Smith, for example, says, by nature, every man is principally recommended to his own care. By nature, every man is principally recommended to his own care. And he says that this idea that we are seeking our own self-interest, our own care, gives rise to, in his understanding, that hidden equilibrium, right, of the market, in which self-interest balances against self-interest, supply balances demand, and so on. And we just have the happy, invisible hand of the market working place. So you get both free market economics on the one hand, and mm-hmm. you get sort of a liberal understanding of the political community on the other, arising from this understanding that at root, mm-hmm. we are kind of self-interested, self-willing individuals.
Yep.
So it is, you know, if you want to say, well, this is a bit divorced from Lutheran. You know, it's one argument you see in someone like Brad Gregory, who says, you know, this is kind of like the views of human nature put forth and by reformers,
yep.
removed yep. from any conception of sanctification and so on, right? Or removed even from an idea that there are God's commandments to simply be obeyed, right? So you still yeah. see, obviously in Calvin, Luther, right? The Decalogue is to be obeyed, right? These mm-hmm. are commandments of God set out by his will, so on and so forth, right? But you remove that, right? And you're left just simply with this conception of human nature. And so you get to a point where it's like, well, what do we have? Well, we have a political economy in which the point is to hoard toilet paper.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Right.
Which leads me then to ScoMo. Right?
I want to pause on that for a second. So there's also an important way in which, as you're alluding to there, the doctrine itself, the doctrine of original sin manifest in this particular peculiar way, via the Enlightenment political tradition, there's a sense in which the doctrine itself generates the reality in which that it's
right,
describing.
Right, exactly.
Right. So if you treat people as if they are fundamentally self-interested individuals that require fear of punishment to keep their self-interest in check, then you'll generate that behavior. So you'll actually turn people into that. And this is a kind of common critique of a lot of liberal politics, that it has a very pessimistic understanding of humanity, that it itself generates that form of human life within
or
itself.
Or even can make it heroic. So another version of this in the, you know, sort of a market economy thinking is yeah. that the more heroic person is the one, the strong man, who can assert their self-interest, who can assert yeah. themselves upon others, and then they become magnanimous. As in,
yeah, so
they
this is
like a philanthropic billionaire, essentially.
And right? this is Ayn Rand's kind of heroic figures, yeah. But I was thinking, you know, if we take the toilet paper example, so what's going on with toilet paper? I think I saw a fascinating video coming out of Zero Books, which is a left-wing publisher that does a lot of Marxist publishing. And it was discussing the phenomena of toilet paper hoarding. And the person presenting it was basically saying, you know, well, what's behind people hoarding toilet paper? Do these people think that it is rational to hoard toilet paper? And he says, no, they don't. No individual thinks that they need to hoard toilet paper at this time. What they think is that their neighbors are stupid enough to think that they do need to do that.
Mm.
And that pessimism about their neighbors is what ends up generating this this need. So it's not a need that they feel intrinsic to themselves. It's a need that they see inside themselves because they have a pessimistic view of other human beings coming out of this kind of capitalist mindset. And then he extrapolates from that and says that's a basic principle that that is present in a lot of liberal discourse. So he applies it directly to the debates around the Democratic nomination. So always the argument is that we can't vote for someone like Bernie Sanders because it's unrealistic, because our neighbors won't go along for that. But if you look at the popularity of the policies themselves, the neighbors, everybody, like a huge portion of the population all would agree that of course, Sanders types of reforms are necessary and good, but everyone is conditioned to vote against them because they assume that no one else will vote for it. And so it's this assumption of a shared irrationality amongst the population that leads people to make irrational choices themselves. And I think a similar thing could be said about understandings of sin as well and deprivation. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's a kind of mimetic desire that has been, we're put into a scenario where we think that our nature is to be competitive.
Yes.
That we are dealing with scarce resources. So, you know, even though the agriculture minister in Australia said Australia produces three times as much food than is necessary for all of Australia. Still, we get these runs on supermarkets, right? Still, we get all this because there's an idea that we have complete scarcity as opposed to you can have infinite plenitude if you apportion resources correctly, right?
Yeah.
So this is why on the ScoMo point, you know, he says it's un-Australian, right?
Mm.
Now, I found that so fascinating because, you know, you could be in the United States, you could say it's un-American, whatever you want to put in there. I thought, but is it? Is it un-Australian? Is it un-Australian to hoard? And is it un-Australian to think I'm entitled to my beach sunning afternoon on a Friday or whatever, you know, as against a notion of common good, public health and so on, right? You know, we've been told that we have this particular human nature, as you said, one that is separated from God's grace on the ends of living well and is just about competition, you know, sort of between the self-interested parties who then have to accumulate and, you know, and if there's a supply for it, well, then I can meet its demand, right?
Yes. And it's also coming from the leader of a party who has been encouraging people to hoard property for the last, I don't know, 10 or so years, and has been encouraging this kind of accumulative cutthroat behavior as normal practice. Not just normal practice, but the way in which prosperity for all will be achieved is through hoarding on a larger scale.
Yeah,
turn around and then say that somehow this was against the national character, but no, like our society has been functioning on people who have access to the most resources, hoarding them and not using them for a social good. So we've got tens of thousands of empty houses, while we've got people living on the streets, and they're just being held.
Or even just the marketization of things. So, you know, neoliberal governments, the idea is that you govern less, but you actually in some ways govern more because you privatize most things. And so things become more and more contractually based and more then actually imposing themselves upon people's lives. But you get, you know, so in education, we think about more as a consumer mentality at the moment, right? Or in your field of disability, right? You get, we've talked about this before, a complete orientation towards a notion of market-driven outcomes and so on, right? And then to turn around and say, uh-oh, suddenly we have to think outside of the market in terms of some conception of the common good, right? It's very difficult to then, I think, step outside of that. And so what you end up getting as well is something that bats around in my brain a bit because you mention it maybe on one of these or maybe just in person. When you said to me as a newcomer here that the Australian character is ultimately juvenile.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's something that a number of years ago I heard Waleed Ali say when he was trying to define the national character. He said, I think I'm getting it right. He said, irreverent, but with ultimate acquiescence to authority.
That's right. So you get here this...
And so it's adolescent. I would describe that as adolescent.
Right,
so
adolescent,
It's kind of thumbing our nose at authority, but secretly wanting to be punished to know that we're that we're still significant.
So here you now have a scenario in which if you do have these practices, right, that take place and they're detrimental to our common good, nobody has built up the virtue to think, maybe I shouldn't grab 20 packets of toilet paper or at least a sufficient number of people haven't, that you then need a strong hand, right? So you need the authoritarian hand to come in and so on, and or you need various forms of measures to come in and so on, which is not, you know, to say those measures are wrong, because actually they may be entirely necessary because of what's been created.
But the form of capitalism that has developed has encouraged this kind of behavior that it is the state's role to intervene, to stop me. And if that's not going to happen,
I can
then
do it.
It's not just, I almost have an obligation,
right?
Like a moral obligation to act as selfishly as possible within the confines of the law. And the law acts as my conscience.
Yeah.
And apart from the threat of state intervention, I am amoral.
Yeah.
I am an amoral actor.
I mean, all this really is to say, dear listener, is that Dave and I are quickly running out.
I'm actually fine. I've got a giant box of Who Gives a Crap.
You got a giant box. Yeah. He's the hoarder. He's been poo-pooing on everyone. And then he just tells us he's got a box of the stuff. Gosh. There was one, we got to finish off, but there's one quote that bounced around my head from Ambrose of Milan that I thought was just brilliant, and actually touched on something again that you raised when you were talking about the rich, you know, and the problem with the when you're on one of your class rants, right, about the problem with the rich, right? Anyway, here's this from the story of Naboth. Here's this great quote when he's giving a sermon. He says, "To be rich in feeling is to have no want. To have full coffers is to know no satisfaction for the yearnings of the breast. That is why the rich man is so greedy. He combines the possessiveness of wealth and the complaints of poverty."
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't it?
That is the national character.
He combines the possessiveness of wealth and the complaints of poverty.
Yep. That is the national character, isn't it?
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, we're probably out of time now, so we better wrap it up.
It's theft from the commons, David.
Thanks so much for joining us. Sorry that we had to take a few weeks off. As I said, we're relative Luddites, and it's taken a lot of patience from Liam to coach us through how to do this on our own. So thanks to Liam. Thanks for trusting us with your expensive microphones. Please like us on Facebook. You can find us by searching for The Eucatastrophe. Follow us on Twitter. That's at UCAT, EUCAT, _ podcast. Please write us a review on whatever platform that you listen to us on. That really helps us to kind of gain exposure. Please share us with your friends if you think this is something that people would enjoy to listen to. And please join us next week as we kind of continue this theme of, I suppose it's our pandemic trilogy that we're in at the moment. Next week we're going to be talking about...
Oh God, it's not J.J. Abrams infused though.
Yeah, we're going to really stuff up the ending. but next week we're going to be talking about what it means to be the church at a time where we are not allowed to gather together. So we'll talk to you then. Until then, bye.